Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Fred Rosen follows a killer's trail back in time 2 decades to discover how a monster slipped through the legal system. When police in Tampa, Florida arrested Larry Singleton in 1997 for brutally murdering prostitute Roxanne Hayes, they soon realized it wasn't the man's first violent attack. Back in 1978, he had gained notoriety as the Mad Chopper for raping and cutting off the arms of 15-year-old Mary Vincent on a patch of desolate, sun-scorched land 5 miles off the highway near Modesto, California. When Singleton was let out of prison on supervised parole after serving only 8 years for his crimes, no community in California would accept him. He eventually moved back to his home in Florida, where he killed Hayes nearly 20 years after his original crime. But his first victim, Vincent, had survived, walking nearly a mile to get help after the assault, and testified against him at the trial for murdering Hayes. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Mad Chopper, How the Justice System Let a Mutilator Free, This Time to Kill, with my special guest, Fred Rosen. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Fred Rosen. Good evening, Fred. Good evening, Fred Rosen. Good evening, Fred Rosen.
Hello.
Hello, Fred. Good evening.
Good evening, Dan. How are you?
Fine, thank you. We had another caller, so I guess it's someone just listening in. So welcome to the program. Welcome back, Fred.
Well, it's my pleasure. I can understand. I know what was happening while there was a problem. That's the NSA. They're making trouble, Dan. You know what I mean?
Okay. Sure. Well, that's good. More listeners, the better.
Hey, you know, I never thought about that. They could be listening
sure.
in Washington.
Sure, they're true crime fans.
We're not supposed to get political, I suppose, right?
No.
How are you, Dan? How are you?
Fine, thank you, Fred. How are you? Busy as usual, I see.
Yes, sir. I am. And it was funny because I reread, the Mad Chopper today. And, you know, because unlike some people who do what you do, you actually read the book and ask
right.
incredibly intelligent questions. And I got to tell you, when I got to the end of it, and I know I wrote it, I had tears in my eyes because of Mary Vincent.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was really something. And, you know, I haven't looked her up lately. And, obviously we're going to talk about it. But, you know, it's very, very interesting, you know, how these things play out and how the justice system works, regardless of the country. And I'm very aware that, thank God, you have listeners all over the world. And so it's not just a question of what happens in the United States. It's Canada. It's Australia. It's England. It's Germany. You know, we're all in this together.
Now, let's get to the question I always ask, because I'm curious, what exactly brought you this opportunity to do this book, The Mad Chopper? How did you come to this book?
Well, this, it's, you know, in reading, again, in reading the book again, it reminded me that this is pretty unique. What happened was, it's 20 years ago, okay? And what happened was, my daughter had just been born. And I was in Valparaiso, Indiana, waiting to go upstairs to the neonatal unit to hold her, meet her, you know. And before we went upstairs, I had a local paper. And I'm reading the local paper, and then I see the picture of this dude, Larry Singleton, staring up at me from page 3. I don't remember what paper it was, but it doesn't make any difference. And I start reading, and it said that this guy had been captured in Hillsborough County, Florida, which is the Tampa area, for murdering a prostitute. And I had written a book called Lobster Boy there about a crime there. And I went, gee, this is, I know these people and stuff. And, you know, I know all the cops and the prosecutors and so forth. And what happened was, Dan, it was serendipity. I got a phone call from my editor, Paul Dennis, who at that time was the editor-in-chief of Kensington Books. And this fellow, Paul Dennis, is largely responsible for the way that true crime became a popular genre. And Paul said to me, Fred, I was just reading the Daily News, a New York newspaper, and he said there's a front page story about a guy called the Mad Chopper. I said, I just saw the same picture. He says, that's your next book. I said, what? And I told him my daughter had just been born, and I said, well, this seems a little bit violent even for me. And he goes, Fred, you just became a father. You need work. And that's how this book came about.
Amazing. Now let's get to Berkeley, California, where you set the stage.
Yes.
This is 1978, University of California, a very unique university, an incredible time, 1978. And this is the University of California, say, across the bay from San Francisco. And
yes,
she sets out this 15-year-old girl, Mary Vincent, 15 years old. She had, as you've set the background, she had a companion named Diego Montoya, and ironically, and very bizarrely, he was accused of raping a different 15-year-old girl, but she was dedicated to him, and so she decided to help him out, and she was going to see her lawyer in Marin County Civic Center, and she called her grandfather. She didn't have any money, Ricker Vincent, in Los Angeles, and she said she was going to visit him, ask him to get some money. So she was hitchhiking, and she had hitchhiked, and she got to what they call Hitchhiker's Corner. So take it from there, what happened at Hitchhiker's Corner and who she meets.
Well, what happens is, Dan, she's at Hitchhiker's Corner, which is a place on the University of California at Berkeley's campus where kids would go to hitchhike. And a dude pulls up in a van, and he says, where are you going? And she says, I'm going to Los Angeles, blah, blah, blah. And this guy is a guy with I love this word, bulbous nose. And he's in his early 50s. And he's a tall guy. He's very well built, and he seemed pretty innocent enough. And she gets in the car with him, and the next thing they're driving they leave Berkeley, which is east of San Francisco, and he's really supposed to go south, to get to Los Angeles, but he keeps going east. And she gets very suspicious, like, what's this about? And he gives her some BS story, and eventually he takes her to a house where his a house that he has, and what he does is he said, listen, he says, if you help me load some stuff into the van, I'll give you some money and I'll take you south to Los Angeles. She says, okay. So they go to the house. She helps them load the stuff into the van. And a lot of it is dog food, believe it or not. They get back in the van, and he starts imbibing from a gallon jug. And I didn't know people do this sort of stuff, because it turns out that in the gallon jug, he's got 200% alcohol, Dan, which he cuts
right
with water. And the next thing you know, he winds up, they're driving and they keep going east. And she's going, what's going on here? Well, this guy winds up raping this poor girl. And then it gets worse. Should I keep going, or do you want to just ask the questions?
Yeah, no. So there's a point where you talk about, she has, again, there's some red flags come up, because he acts bad at first, then he apologizes, then he takes her for a little dinner. Everything seems to be okay. Again, this is just a 15-year-old girl. That's, you know, in that time, that was hitchhiking was normal.
Yeah, man, she's. Yes, I think that's an excellent point to make, that in the late 70s in California, this was the end of the hippie era. This was not an uncommon situation for kids to hitchhike. This was before people were worried about serial killers and so forth. So she was just doing what a lot of kids did, because she wanted to go to Los Angeles to talk to her granddaddy, who was going to help her out financially and so forth. And the guy takes her to dinner. But again, eventually what happens is he's drinking. And like some alcoholics, Larry Singleton, which is the name of the bad guy, he becomes a different human being under the influence of alcohol. And he winds up raping Mary Vincent. And then it gets worse from there. To believe, you know, which is hard to believe, ladies and gentlemen, but it does. It gets much worse from there.
Now, you talk about her being raped, and he is not taking her anywhere near Los Angeles at all. He takes her into the Del Puerto Canyon, a really deserted and isolated place. And there's a point where he says, you know, I got to take a leak. And she says, me too. So
can we say that on radio?
Yeah.
Okay, Dan, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So he's talking about, he's raping her brutally, but now he's got his hands around her neck. So it's a little different than the previous rape.
Yes.
And he decides, he looks around and he sees this drainage pipe. So what does he do?
Well, we need to explain this. That's an excellent point. What happens is, and I went out there when I wrote the book, I can't write about something unless I see it and breathe it so that the reader understands what it's about.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, and I, just so that people understand, we're talking about, I don't know how many miles east it is of, maybe it's 25 miles east of Modesto, California. And what happens is, he says he needs to take a leak, and the girl says the same thing. And he's in this really isolated place. I mean, we're talking, it's a movie set, you know. People have seen this stuff in the movies, you know, an isolated, like high desert. I think they call it the high desert. I'd have to look at my geography, but it's a very deserted area and a lot of rocks and so forth. And he parks the van near a culvert, and they get out. And the next thing you know, he is assaulting her again. But you want me to say what happens?
Yeah.
I guess I should. All right, I'll just say, ladies and gentlemen, this is probably the... I think in my career it is the most horrific physical assault I know of, okay? We're not just talking rape. What happens is Larry Singleton realizes that he needs, since he has raped her, if she survives, she can testify against him. So the idea is, what do you do to prevent identification? And we're not dealing with a guy who's got all of his oars in the water. And what he decides to do is throw her down on the ground, and he takes a hatchet, and he cuts off her arms below the elbow so that there won't be any fingerprints. And then he takes her body, and he thinks she's dead, and stuffs her into the culvert. And this idiot then takes the severed limbs and puts them in his back in his van and drives off. And Mary, God was with her, survives. And what happens is, she winds up, and she's conscious, ladies and gentlemen, when he does this. But God was with her, because what happens is there's a lot of mud, so that the stumps that she has now are in the mud, and that stops the hemorrhaging and the bleeding. She will subsequently wake up, and when she does, this girl has so much survival in her, she will walk almost 2 miles until a good Samaritan helps her. What happens is Singleton, the bad guy, goes back west, and he's driving over the Oakland Bay Bridge, which many of us have driven over. And you know what he does, Dan? He opens up the driver's side door, and he tosses the limbs out into the water, which turned out to be a very, very big mistake. And this is why, you know, people like me get to write about people like this, because they're not the brightest apples in the bunch. They just figure that nobody's going to know about it, but that's not what happens here.
You talk about him attempting to kill her, because basically that's what he thought he was doing, was murdering her and cutting off her hands so that she could not be identified if the body was found. And he tried to do at least a good job of hiding the body for the time period, and then believed he would take the hands and throw them away, as he did. The image that I get from the way you've written this book is that, and this image is still in my head, and it's been in my head since I start reading this book.
Oh,
is
wow.
Her wandering down the highway naked, delirious, 80 or 90 degree weather. The first car that sees her after she's managed to walk a mile or more, he's so frightened, he turns around and takes off the other way. It takes her, she doesn't even know how many hours before someone else comes and saves her. A man comes and takes her into his car, drives to an airport, and calls 911. Amazing. That image of this woman with just bloodied stumps, naked, walking down the road, asking for help. Incredible.
Yeah, and you know, it's so, what's so interesting about what you're saying you would have thought, given the what you're saying, the images, and you're right, the image, it's an incredible image. You would have thought that in some way somebody would have done a MOW movie of the week or a movie, but that never happened. And I suspect it's because it's so horrific. But I think what's very interesting here is that she, you're right. I mean, she's walking in this, you know, it's 80 or 90 degrees, and she's naked because that's, you know, he stripped her of her clothing. And the first dude that sees her walking along in the shimmering desert heat just keeps going. Well, I don't know who that person is, but if he's listening, I don't have anything to say. But the second individual who sees her is a terrific human being, and he puts her into the car, and they go to the to a local airstrip. And that's really where I feel that the police really, you know, there's so much attention. I was thinking about this today, Dan. There is so much attention today about police officers not doing their job and so forth. Well, these police officers in Stanislaus County, California, were fantastic. And they were able to not only rush her to the hospital to save her life, but the detective on the case, his name was Brashears, was able to not only interview her, but he used hypnosis in order to get her to recall certain details which would eventually help convict Singleton. And, you know, as I'm reading this, I wrote it, you know. I'm thinking, you know what? What's going on? You know, this is the kind of story that needs to be told, because so much attention has been focused on the negativity regarding police officers, but this is a detective. And this guy is wonderful, and so are the detectives at this police department. And so Mary Vincent is able to give Lieutenant Brashears a description of her assailant, and they get a fantastic police artist to do a composite, which they put out over the wires. And it's like when, you know, as I was reading it today, I'm going, you know, I don't know if they still do this stuff today, Dan. I honestly don't know. You know, all I can tell you is these cops were fantastic, and they saved this girl's life, and then they were eventually able to get the bad guy.
Yeah, you talk about, and again, this is in the last few episodes, you talked about some incredible efforts to bring in hypnosis into the mix. And
yeah.
not only did this 15-year-old have the wherewithal to remember important details, like that he was a merchant marine, that he had a first aid kit in the window, that he had another house in Reno, Nevada, and then they put her under. And it's amazing what you chronicle. The information that they did get, they didn't know the value of at that time, but they still, again, these dedicated cops were incensed over this and were outraged. And so even more so, they worked with some dedication to try to solve this. And Todd Mack did a fantastic job. And so the neighbor, a neighbor that had lived in San Pueblo, said, you know, it took her a couple days to come to the decision, but she called the police and said, I think this is my neighbor, and take it from there. How much information they got from Mary, and again, traumatized as she was still cooperating with the police and Detective Brashears. But as you say, the break in the case comes from, again, that good work from that description. And what did the police do with this tip?
Well, what happened, you know what really gets me? in my generation, Dan, Sammy Davis Jr. would go on TV shows. Here I go, going off topic. I realize that. And he'd always say something really terrific about the host. What gets me is that I want all of our listeners to understand how you really absorb the information that you read and ask incredibly intelligent questions. Okay, you can give me $5 afterwards, and if you want to, it can be Canadian. So anyway.
Okay. It'll have to be 10.
Okay, now here's the thing. What happens is this fellow, Mr. Mack, does a sketch of the bad guy, and it goes out, and a woman in California sees it. You know, we're talking to live in California, says, you know, that looks like Larry Singleton. And he used to be my neighbor, okay? And simultaneously, Brashears, who's been this is unbelievable to me. I mean, this is like Sherlock Holmes stuff. Brashears, the detective, has been trained in forensic hypnosis. So he hypnotizes her. And what he does, I mean, it's just, what he does is he gets it to recall the events in the third person so she's not traumatized. And what she remembers is that when she went to Singleton's house, and again, she doesn't know his name at this point, she just knows he's a merchant marine because that's what he said he was, there was a first aid kit in the window of the house, which you mentioned. Well, what happens is the police put together what Mary says, the victim, and what Sandra, the neighbor, tells them about Singleton, and they go to the dude's house, and they go in, and they did it by the numbers. They get themselves a search warrant. You know, this isn't some stupid TV show. You know, they get a search warrant. They go in, and now they find in the fireplace the guy. Some stuff was being burned, and it turned out it was Mary Vincent's clothing.
Right.
So now they know who they're looking for. And they keep going, and they find he's done it. The guy was a merchant marine, and he was making a lot of money, which, by the way, that was an education. I didn't know they did. And the dude had another residence in Nevada. And that leads the police in Nevada to capture him. And when they do, Singleton waives extradition and they send him back to California. So now they got their suspect. I mean, this was just such terrific policing. I don't know any other way of putting it, you know. And there's one other thing we should mention. Earlier I said that when Singleton is driving over the Oakland Bay Bridge, he throws the severed arms out the window. Guess
right.
what, folks? One of them winds up going into an estuary and washes up, and they find it. I mean, a fisherman finds it, calls the police, and now they have the arm to match to her stump forensically. And it's incredible because, you know, because there's two ways of looking at this. One way is, of course, how awful it is and the trauma. But the other way of looking at this is what you said earlier, which is the police determined that they were going to get this guy because nobody had ever seen anybody do what this guy did. And they said, we're going to get him. And you know what? Everybody, what they did was they used the law. They didn't go outside the law. They used the law. They used technology. And most importantly, they used shoe leather to get this guy and their brains. And to me, that's like, you know, as I'm reading what I wrote, I'm going, gee, are these people still around today? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they identify that hand. They make a match. They also now have enough to bring in Lawrence Singleton.
Yes, sir.
So he doesn't come in with representation. He comes in, they have him speaking without any kind of lawyer. So what does he have to say? What does he say to, and how do they conduct this interview? It's very interesting.
It's really interesting. Brashears, you know, it's fun, you know, as we're talking, I didn't look it up, Dan. I'm hoping that he's still around, because this guy, he was good, and his partner Reese. And what they did was, they get him into an interrogation room, it'd be very interesting to find out how this stuff works in other countries. But they gave him his rights. You know, you have the right to remain silent, et cetera, et cetera. Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to the representation of an attorney. And he declines, and he signs off on his right. And they start talking to him. Well, long story short, Singleton comes up with a story. He claims that after he picked up Mary Vincent, he picked up two hitchhikers someplace else. One has the name of Larry. Gee, there's a coincidence. And one has the name of Pedro. And he insists throughout the interrogation that these individuals were there. He insists that Mary had a stick. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not making this up. He says that she had a stick he was threatening him with, and that later she gets access to a knife that's in the van, and that Pedro gets access to a gun he kept in the van, though he didn't know where he kept it, though. Gee, you know, maybe somebody should call the NRA on this guy. But anyway, he had this gun, allegedly, Pedro. And so what he tries to do is slough off any responsibility for what happens to Mary Vincent. And he claims that he didn't do a damn thing to her. And he keeps invoking God, Dan. He keeps saying, God, I didn't do this. Under God, you know, he keeps talking about God. I didn't do this, blah, blah, blah. Brashears keeps boring in. The cop keeps going in on him and says, you know, it's a textbook case of how to conduct an interrogation. And he says, no, Mr. Singleton, you're lying, buddy. He doesn't say it in those words, but basically that's what he says. And he keeps trying to get the guy, and this is really, it was so interesting. He wanted to know why. Why would he cut this girl's arms off? Well, not only will Singleton not admit to doing it, he won't admit to any motive. So the police then have to put their case together with the forensics, the evidence, and with Mary Vincent's testimony.
You also include that part of his story is that this big, tough merchant marine and quite a muscular guy at that time, still in good shape,
yes,
big
yes.
guy, was threatened by this 15-year-old with a little stick. And
yeah, with a stick.
Go ahead, sir.
No, you go ahead. No, you go ahead.
And then he says that she wanted to get stoned all the time, she claimed.
Oh, yeah.
She loved oral sex. So just demeaning, denigrating her character, of course, talking about some Mexican guy and some other guy. And to the credit of Reese and Brashears, Detective Reese just lets this guy go. But at the same time, he lets him give him enough, as you call it, rope to hang himself. He's also taking down all the inconsistencies that this guy has when just let him go and let him talk. And he's also at some point very, very challenging of this guy. At some point it's not nice at all, and he's challenging him, trying to get a confession. And this guy seems cool as a cucumber, doesn't he?
I would say totally as cool as a cucumber. I mean, it's really, you know, now, you know, they were what Brashears and Reese were trying to do was play on the guy's conscience. And by the way, I believe that I didn't get into it in the book, but this guy is not a sociopath. I don't see that at all. He had a lot of problems, which we would later find out. And the cops at the time didn't know this. But what I'm getting at is that he would not take any responsibility for what he did. And this isn't a this is not a situation where, you know, he's smart enough to say, "Hey, get me a lawyer." He is having problems rationalizing his actions, and there will later be speculation that he had an alcoholic blackout. And what's interesting about that is, under American criminal law, if that occurs, that's a defense. It mitigates the crime. But the two cops were looking at it from the point of view of, you know something, this guy is lying. They felt right from the get-go that he was lying. And what he was doing is what a lot of individuals do who rape a woman, which is trying to essentially put her on trial for her actions. We're talking a 15-year-old girl. He would actually claim that he thought she was 21. Excuse me? You know? And he also, you know, here's a guy who not only was he a big, muscular guy in good shape at that point, the guy, oh my God, you know, and it's funny, as I was reading the book again today, because I said to myself, Dan's going to ask me questions. I better know what the hell I'm talking about. And he was a veteran of the Korean War, and he was on Pork Chop Hill, which was one of the worst battles of the Korean War, where the communist Chinese attacked our troops, and we lost at least 50% of them. The point being, this guy was in, you know, essentially hand-to-hand combat. So the idea that a 15-year-old girl could hold this individual at bay with a stick, if you believe that one, I got a bridge in Brooklyn I'll sell you for $5.
All right.
Dan, you don't want to buy the bridge for $5. You don't want to buy the bridge for $5. No, okay, good. Okay. Go ahead.
Now you talk about this technique they employ, or this ruse they employ on him. They say they're trying to get this confession. They're pushing as hard as they can, and they think they might get one. They said, listen, we found some blood on the hatchet. How do you explain that? Mm. And so how does he respond?
Oh, well, he says, it goes further than that. He says, I don't know how it got there. I didn't use the hatchet. I haven't been hunting for a long time. And he also talked about how there was a string on the hatchet, and the string was, on the handle. And he talked, and the cops asked him about why it was that the string was broken, or torn rather. And he came up with some, you know, it was all BS, you know. And so he doesn't have any explanation for any of this. He has no explanation, you know. It's the other guy defense. You know, somebody else did it. Somebody else used my stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And that's basically it. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he, and look, do, look, Do I understand why he would say that? Yeah. He's not going to confess. But it was a bunch of BS. Can I say that on radio?
Sure.
Thank you. So, you know, it really doesn't go anyplace. I mean, it's just the fact that, you know, the cops, just like us, as we're talking today, and I'm sure the listeners around the world are thinking to themselves, why would a person commit such a horrendous crime? And you know something? I don't know, you know, while logic would say he wants to get rid of the arms because of identity, okay? And granted, it's the 70s, so there's no DNA going down or anything like that. Still, what we're talking about is violence, if there is such a thing, over the top. And we will later find out that he would claim, Singleton, that he was abused growing up by his mother. And, and this was something the police didn't know at the time. It comes out much, much later. And, you know, that is certainly indicative of the problems he had throughout his life with women. And I might add that he had a daughter, and he physically abused the daughter as a teenager. Of course, he denied. This guy lived in denial his entire life. And, you know, as we're talking about it, you know what word comes to mind, Dan?
What?
The word that comes to mind is, in order for somebody like this to continue to do what he does, abuse a child, for instance, enabler, people enabled him throughout his life. And one of the things the police were interested in was, as a merchant marine, did he do stuff in other places? They weren't able to find that out, but that's because, for a lot of reasons. Number one, the guy sailed all over the world, so you'd have to have a fortune in taxpayers' money to track all this stuff down. And I suspect, as we're talking right now, that he raped women and or abused them in various ways in other venues. But they didn't have the resources at that point to go after him in that respect. But one thing that we do know is that when people are this abusive, we know that it tends to be a pattern. And again, I'm going to say the same thing, tend to be enabled by other individuals. And you know what I mean, Dan? Look, I've got a relative, Dan, okay, who a couple of years ago disagreed with me in a political discussion. The dude reached across the table and tried to hit me. First cousin. Why does he get away with it? Because people enabled him. Same situation. If, you know, as people listen to what we're talking about, take a closer look at people you know that might be relatives, that might be acquaintances. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of you will find that there are individuals who do stuff like this. I'm not talking murder, but I'm talking about abuse. And that's the tip of the iceberg. I thought I
now
said that
back,
pretty well.
Yeah, you did. Back to the victim of this crime, this Mary Vincent. Again, this is the outcome of this book for me, is that I just picture her, at images in my head, but also just a sad story. And we won't get ahead of ourselves here, but at this time at the same time that they're questioning this guy, And she's a victim of crime. And so, potentially, she needs new arms. So she needs the victim of crime compensation program that they have in California, which is just new. And her, you say her medical costs are likely to exceed over $10,000. But the only problem is she's not from California.
Yes. Oh, you picked up on something really good here, buddy. Yeah. They had to move the laws around a little bit to make to try and get her benefits. But quite frankly, I'm just going to say it, okay? California did not do their job. Here's a woman who the crime is committed in California, and she's going to need new arms. And this, now again, we're talking, this is 78, so we're talking, what is that? How many years ago is that? 40 years ago, right? It's almost 40 years ago. Now, of course, the technology has changed since then. But the bottom line is nobody came forward to really give her help. In fact, it was only, as we're talking about it, when I was reading the book again, I was laughing because there's a section in the book where what happens is I mentioned that Jamie Summers flew in. Jamie Summers was the Bionic Woman, which was a TV show on NBC. And the actress who played the part flew in to help her out. And the Bionic Woman, of course, had bionic limbs. And the bottom line here is that there's no evidence that anybody in the entertainment business, anybody in government there, industry, et cetera, came forward to help her get new limbs. And in fact, at that point, the technology was the same as what had gone on in World War II. Some people may remember a movie called The Best Years of Our Lives, in which Harold Russell, who wins the Oscar, is bereft of his arms because of an accident in World War II. He's a soldier, and he gets hooks for arms. Well, this is basically what happened with Mary Vincent. And not only that, what is so sad is that they forget about the technology. The artificial limbs that they give her, they don't last. So she's got problems with them. And you don't see anybody coming forward to help her. Now, I don't know I haven't looked it up. I guess I should have. I'm sure Mary at this point would probably be in about 50. So, but I don't know if she's ever gotten anything better than what she had. And it's not only sad, but it's wrong. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's wrong. And so here's this woman. I write that she's been denied a future. What this guy took away from her was her future. And, I mean, look at, what's his name? The guy in, what's his name? The guy in South Africa, the convicted murderer. The guy's had artificial limbs, really sophisticated. But this woman didn't have that advantage. And I don't know why people didn't come forward at that time. And I don't know what's happened since. So I have to be very frank about that. But I do know that by the time we get to the late 90s, when Singleton, and I'm getting ahead here, is eventually tried for another crime, she's in the same situation. And I'm only going back about, you know, 19 or 18 years. So she doesn't have a very sophisticated set of artificial limbs.
Now, she has to go to the grand jury. Grand jury doesn't take much to get an indictment for this guy. Tell us what the outcome of the trial is, and the most interesting part of this, because we already know that Valuta do that he got out to do this again, so how on earth, what is he charged with, and what kind of sentence?
Oh.
So let's get to what the outcome is. That's, we know what would happen. But how, what are the conditions? What are the rules? How is it that, what's he charged with first?
Well, the grand jury, which in the United States is a lot individuals that get together, they're voters, and they get together in a big room, and grand juries in the United States are generally manipulated by the prosecutor. In other words, if the prosecutor wants to get an indictment, it's pretty easy to get one. You know, it's rubber stamped. I don't know how it works in other places. You know, but I just want to explain that, okay? So now here's what happens, Dan. They charge Singleton with it's a variety of charges, everything from sexual assault to physical assault. And that's where it gets interesting. In other words, there's nothing in the law then, and I suspect now, where, you know, you charge somebody, there's nothing that's, you know, where you say, okay, you cut off somebody's arms, blah, blah, blah. Uh-uh, it's physical assault. So the idea is that they're going to charge him, and then, you know, and the grand jury comes in with their indictment, and it's physical assault, sexual assault, essentially. You know, it's a number of charges, attempted murder, and then it's going to go to trial. And in California history, you know, these things change over the years, but there were some limitations regarding what they could convict him on, and most importantly, what the sentence would be. See, and that's where it gets really interesting, because, you know, you can't change a law just because somebody does something. I mean, you can change it subsequently, but the fact that he cut off her arms doesn't mean that you can then say, okay, he cut off her arms, she should get life. Well, I don't think most of us would say that would be unreasonable, but you can't change the law. So basically, it's a certain amount of years behind bars. And in fact, the most the guy can get at the time, in the late 70s in California, and admittedly, folks, California is a liberal state, the most this dude can get is 14 years behind bars. That's the most, if the jury convicts on all charges.
At the same time, you put, though, that in real terms, with good behavior, despite any of this past record in terms of this crime and the heinous nature, he can be out in 8 years on good behavior. That's the maximum he can do. Correct?
Dan, this was an education for me. I mean, one day we should have a discussion how this works in Canada, Australia, Germany, et cetera, England. But yes, with good behavior, not only good behavior, like if he does certain jobs behind bars, he gets credits. so you can get out. So in other words, the bottom line is, here's a guy who, again, ladies and gentlemen, it's the late 70s. He rapes a 15-year-old girl. He cuts off her arms. He gets sentenced to 14 years. And if he's a good guy behind bars, he'll be out in 8. And that's what happens. He because he is a merchant marine, one of the reasons certainly, and he's used to discipline, he is a model prisoner. And because he's in great shape, nobody's going to mess with him. You know, this is not a guy that's going to, you know, nobody's going to mess with him. And so he gets out in the middle 1980s. When I say gets out, I mean he gets parole. What happens from that point is another story.
This is one of the most unique stories I've ever read in terms of somebody getting out and being forced. Again, tell us what he was forced to do or the government was forced to do and why. I mean, it's, again, right out of a movie. You know, is this a modern-day lynch potential? So tell us about this.
Sure, Dan. You know, it's funny as I was writing it, and again, as I was reading it again, it reminds me of the Old West. And, you know, what happens is the guy comes up for parole, and it's a big deal because the question becomes, where is he going to go? It's a celebrated case within California, and it's getting headlines across the United States. I mean, for God's sakes, 8 years for cutting off a young girl's arms and rape. And now they're going to let him go. They're going to let him go. And so the question then becomes, okay, where's he going to go? Well, they start saying, well, we'll send him back to where he came from, the county in California. Next thing, that county says, are you kidding? We don't want him. And as the state tries to find a place to place him, each venue says, hey, buddy, he's not coming over here. Well, eventually what happens is, now, you know, there's a date. You can't keep somebody, at least then, you couldn't keep somebody in prison beyond a certain date. So now they got to release him, Dan. So the next thing you know, they're moving him around. Ladies and gentlemen, they're moving him around on taxpayer money from town to town in Northern California, and what happens is at one point, he's in one of these towns, and they're keeping it quiet, I should mention this, that's the most important thing. They're keeping it quiet because, you know, it's understandable, the state parole board doesn't want people to know the mad chopper is in their venue. Well, people find out, and at one point, I've never seen this in modern day. A lynch mob forms. He's in some place in Northern California, whatever town. It's not important. The point is, people find out he's there. Oh my God! They show up, and you know, I was actually surprised when I read the accounts that nobody was carrying a rope. You know, I'm thinking to myself, geez, you know. Time to bring in, you know, the United States Marshals. Well, that's not what happened. The locals are trying to take care of it by themselves. And each venue, each town, every time they tried to place him in town A, town B, whatever, their lawyers would go into state court and say, we don't want him. We're not going to take him. And they actually did have a lynch mob in one of these towns. And they got him out, and they, you know, the parole officers, and they took him someplace else. You know, they kept moving this dude around. And of course, this is, you know, this is all being done on the public dollar. Singleton is, you know, he's very happy, of course, that he's out. Hell, he only served 8 years. So now the question becomes, okay, where do we put him so that people can't get to him? And should I explain what happens?
Yes.
What happens is somebody who's smart comes up with the idea, okay, let's put him on the grounds of San Quentin Prison. And the idea is they'll put him there, and he'll have a separate residence. And again, this is on public dollars. And he's actually free to move around, but with his bodyguards. And they decide that he'll serve out the length of his parole there. And it's something like a year or two, whatever it is. And then once he's finished with that, he can go any place he wants to in the world. So that's the compromise that's reached. They'll put him essentially back behind prison walls for his own safety. Now, I've never seen anything like this. And I, ladies and gentlemen, I doubt we'll ever see anything like this again. And hopefully we don't. And that, but that's what happens, you know. And so he's now behind San Quentin's prison walls. And he's serving at his time there, and every once in a while, you know, it's late 70s, he goes to the middle 80s. So, he goes to the movies and whatever, goes out to McDonald's. I pointed out in the book that he's first introduced when he comes out to the microwave oven, you know. And, the guy winds up serving out his parole time essentially behind prison walls. And then it gets really interesting. How's that for a segue?
Yes, well, so now he has to eventually get out. And again, the mob that almost got him, there's still this, politically and practically, and the media and the informed public don't want him in California. So where does he end up, and under what conditions?
You mean after? Well, what happens is, great question. After he serves out his parole, and, you know, we're not, you know, it's funny as we're talking about it right now. You know, it wasn't a long period of parole. You know, it's like a couple of years or something. And so what happens is he's got to, where's he going to go? And he's very aware. He's not a stupid guy. He's a very smart guy. And so where's he going to go so that people don't keep coming after him, which they're doing in California? Well, his home is Tampa, Florida. This is the part that cracked me up in the book and in reality. He's allowed, because he's on parole now, Dan. So according to the rules in California, he's allowed to go wherever he wants. So he didn't go to Hawaii, he didn't go to Alaska, he didn't go to Jamaica, didn't go to Germany. And I said Germany because Anne Marie Ackerman may be listening, my friend. And he goes to Tampa, Florida, because that's where he comes from. And his family tries to help him. And he goes back home. This is where he comes from. And one of his brothers buys him, gee, we should be so lucky, a really nice ranch house. Do you guys call it a ranch house in Canada, by the way?
Sure.
Okay. So he buys him this small ranch house. And, you know, and in other words, ladies and gentlemen, it's one story. And it's in Orient Park, which is not a particularly nice area. And he goes there to live. And he gets smart. And he changes his name to, I think it's Bill Johnson.
Right.
The irony is that the name that he uses is the name of the one-armed man in the old TV show The Fugitive. Gee, duh. So, the one-armed man, ladies and gentlemen. And so, he winds up moving there, and he registers with the police. He's following the law, Dan. But he's going downhill. And, you know, the one thing we haven't touched on, and it's something I've seen in a lot of criminal cases, the dude had a lot of post-traumatic stress syndrome from serving in combat. Number one, it was never dealt with. Why is it? I don't know, but that's the truth. It was never dealt with. The guy was an alcoholic. I'm not talking functioning alcoholic. I'm talking alcoholic. And they did not, nobody required he attend AA meetings or anything of that nature. Okay?
Right.
And so we have an individual with severe emotional and physical problems. And for whatever reason, the system is not dealing with it. So he moves back to Tampa, and oh boy, oh Dan, oh God, when I saw this, when I wrote the book, there's a Yiddish expression I plot. He moved to Gibsonton briefly. Gibsonton is where Lobster Boy takes place. He drank with Grady Stiles Jr., Lobster Boy.
Yeah.
Amazing. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing, you know. I mean, it's amazing. And then what happened was, that was initially. And then the family, as I said, they bought him a place in Orient Park, which I went to. And it was a very nice place, Dan. It was a very nice place. And, I mean, I didn't go in, obviously, you know, but I couldn't do that. But it was really a nice place. And this is where he would live. And he changed his name, as I said, to Bill Johnson. So his neighbors knew him by that name. However, some of them knew his reputation. But he was a very good neighbor. He was into dogs, which some of us are, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're talking about a dude who's in his early 60s, who's a convicted sex offender, convicted of attempted murder, et cetera, and other charges. And he's on Social Security. Do you guys have Social Security?
Yes.
Thank you. Listen, I don't know. I got to ask the question. You know, I know I get off track sometimes, but by the way, I got to tell you, I know I'm getting off track. Sorry, but I didn't know Justin Trudeau was a liberal. How come nobody told me, Dan? So anyway, here's what happens. He starts acting out again. It's very interesting. He starts acting out again. That is, he starts stealing stuff. And so here we got a guy you know, we've talked all about what the dude did. Next thing you know, he's stealing, you know, he's, what do you call it, shoplifting. He's shoplifting. You know, and it's unbelievable stuff, because at one point he shoplifts a couple of times. You know what happens? They give him 2 years. 2 years. You know, I don't understand the system sometimes. You know, what do you got to do to put the guy away for life? You know, he rapes somebody. He takes off her arms. Gets parole. Goes back to his hometown. Shoplifts a couple of times. They put him in jail. Blah, blah, blah. Gets 2 years, gets out again. And, you know, it's, you know, I understand. Look, I know, you know, this is not a science fiction film with Tom Cruise. I realize that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But, man, when you look at what we're talking about here, you know something's going to go down. So he gets out after 2 years, and that sets up what's going to happen next.
Now, you talk about the perfect storm here, a confluence of events. And anyway, he meets this Roxanne, Roxy Hayes, one of the most popular women who was working the streets, 6 foot, 170 pounds. She had met him before. They had exchanged, they'd done business before. She was not apprehensive about him at all. Yes. And then we have a guy named Gene Reynolds. So tell us what happens, because we want to still talk about something else tonight that's very, very important.
Yes.
So
yes,
tell us quickly what happens. What does Gene Reynolds find out? What happens?
Well, first of, Gene Reynolds is a pseudonym, but what happens here is this. Larry Singleton picks up Roxanne Hayes. And he's already done business with her before. She's a prostitute. She's married. I'm sorry, no, sir. She's not married. She's living with an individual. She has a couple of kids. And so what happens is he picks. They've already done business before. He picks her up to his house, the one we mentioned earlier. And during their interaction, she asks for more money because the price of cocaine had gone up and she was an addict. That leads, I'll just say it leads to murder. He takes a knife and it's pretty awful. He starts stabbing her with the knife. And Gene Reynolds is aside from the fact he's one of the creators of MASH, that's the reason I use the name, he's a neighbor, and he hears the commotion, and he looks through the window, and he sees Singleton with his arm going up and down on this woman, and what he doesn't realize is in his arm is a knife. He's stabbing her to death. It's very sad. And at that point, he calls the cops, and because there's a change of shift, it takes them at least 30 minutes to get a car to respond. And what happens is, when the car, ladies and gentlemen, you can't make this stuff up. That's why it's true crime. When the cop comes to the door and knocks on the door, oy, oy, oy. Singleton opens the door. He's naked and he's got blood all over him and he's wearing a condom. Okay?
Unbelievable.
He's wearing a condom. And Singleton actually tries to con the officer not to come into his house. But the officer, of course, does the right thing. Duh. Goes in and he finds Roxanne Hayes dead near, you know, in the living room, stabbed to death. that will eventually lead to Singleton being tried and convicted for murder one in Florida, sentenced to death, because Florida is a death penalty state.
Yes, and incredibly what you include, and again, we're going to have to leave almost our readers or our listeners just hanging here a little bit, but this is an electric chair trial. This story still is very involved, and also the most poignant and profound moment is Mary Vincent with her hooks looking at Larry Singleton in the eye at trial. It's a fascinating, there's still more fascinating information we could impart.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for talking about the Mad Chopper. We also talked before this show, you have some breaking news, and maybe you
can
introduce our next guest. Dan, may
I interrupt before we get to that? I just want to
tell
the listeners, I look after you dudes and dudettes. Tomorrow, this book is on sale for $1.99 at Amazon. For ebook, I just want to let you know this. So don't buy it tonight.
Right, right.
If you want to, if you want to buy it, do it tomorrow. Okay. Just want to let you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, it's very good. Now, there's a story that you have been working on, and you're very, very passionate about, involving James Brown. So why don't you just introduce a little bit about what you're working on and who you're working with, and introduce our next guest, and I'm sure has called in.
Yes, sir. What happened was, over a year ago, I got contacted through Facebook. A friend on Facebook told me about Jackie Hollander. Jackie spells her name J-A-C-Q-U-E, just like Jacqueline Kennedy. And what happened was, Jackie had been James Brown's, the godfather of soul, a music producer, his music producer, rather. And Jackie... on April 1st, 1988, was raped by Brown very brutally. And what? And so she, I was contacted by somebody. We started chatting. We decided to do a book. Jackie became a tremendous advocate for rape victims, which we can talk about more. Bottom line is, while we were working on our story, she started telling me all these details about James Brown's death in 2006. And as it turns out, it wasn't what the death certificate says, which is that he died from pneumonia. Didn't happen, folks. And we'll talk about that. But bottom line is, Jackie had been very influential with Mr. Brown in terms of establishing the I Feel Good Trust for underprivileged children. And the idea was that when he died, the majority of his estate, which was $100 million, would go to that trust. Well, that's not what happened. And so I got very passionate, as you say, about it, because not only didn't that happen, but because Jackie became a detective, essentially, to try and solve Brown's suspicious death so that the trust could be reinstated, because the trust was broken by Brown's family. So we got involved, and that sort of led us to the point that we're at now. I hope I summarized it okay.
Yes, I think so. I want to introduce Jackie Hollander to the program. Are you on the air, Jackie?
Hi, Dan. It's really good to get to talk to you. I've heard so much about you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, we have only a few minutes left. We have 8 or 9 minutes left in the program. But what can you tell us? Because I know there are some things that you are not willing to tell us right now. But what can you tell us about the state of the case just in the last few days in terms of development? What can you tell us about any new developments and what you're doing and who you're speaking to? Tell us what you can about the new developments in this case.
Okay, well, I think you know, I think Fred has shared with you that I came across a bunch of evidence. And it's taken about a year for all of this to come to fruition, but I don't want to say and use the word investigation by the police. But I'm just letting them do their job right now, and I don't want to break too much about it, but I can tell you that law enforcement has stepped in, and I put it in their hands and also in God's hands.
Now, you were involved with James Brown, and Fred has told us about this assault. At the same time, though, the big part of this case, as I understand it, too, is that, and Fred had mentioned it, too, is that James Brown, because of his background, had certain concerns for children and had set up this fund. So tell us a little bit more about this trust fund.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Basically, I started the trust with him. I came up with the idea for it, the I Feel Good Trust, and even came up with the name. When I met James Brown, he really did not do a lot of charity work, and that was my forte. And James and I became 50-50 partners, and we did, I have just cases full of the benefits that we did to raise money for children from Scottish Rite all the way across the board. And he had told me that when he died, everything would go into the trust that we built, the I Feel Good Trust. I think it's very clear that if you read Buddy Dallas's affidavit, it says I am the 50-50 partner. He was the lawyer for James Brown for 30 years, and he was there when we did everything. So, yes, you know, it unfortunately, greed and it has been taken control of by the state of South Carolina and a lot of corrupt lawyers, and hence not one child has received one penny in 10 years.
Wow.
Not one.
Wow.
Now the idea, idea that you're, what we, for our audience, is that this trust fund is at odds with James Brown's biological children. And other people that he has had relationships with, if you could explain.
Well, Mr. Brown had a wife that really wasn't a wife, who was married to another man from Pakistan. She gave birth to a child, which she claims is James Brown. But as a rape victim, when I got raped by James Brown, Mr. Brown had to later showed that there was no way he could have gotten me pregnant. Mr. Brown had a vasectomy. I now have come across another video footage clip of an interview that after he married this woman who claims to be the mother of this child, he's now had two vasectomies, one in the 80s and one in the 90s. And two vasectomies, you can't have a child. Plus, he had diabetes, and he had cancer in the gonads. And I mean, you add all of that up together, there's no way. But they have given this woman all kinds of carte blanche because of her power, her connections to people. It's a big cover-up.
In terms of
it's probably one of the largest cover-ups ever in the United States of America, involving millions of dollars.
Now, you also talk about the children not receiving anything from James Brown, and is there any contributing factor in this from those children as well?
Are you talking about his children? Or are you talking
his
about
children?
Well, his children.
His children.
His children just want the money for themselves. They have recently, after they have caused such a commotion for 10 years, finally done a little settlement. It said they want their father's wishes honored. But, of course, it's a little hard to honor his wishes when they've spent 10 years seeing to it that his wishes were not granted. I mean, this is a man that is buried in his daughter's backyard when his wishes were to be buried by his parents.
May I add, Dan?
Yes.
That's illegal.
Yes, Jackie is correct. He's not buried. He's in an above ground.
No, he's not. He's above the ground.
I don't even know if you call it a tomb, but the most important point here is this. When he died, even though he'd gone to the hospital initially with a diagnosis of a drug overdose and was scheduled to be released Christmas Day 2006, and he was supposed to be 100%. Next thing you know, the guy dies. The death certificate says it's pneumonia. And the family, according to the records, insisted no autopsy be performed. No autopsy.
The daughter did. Yama Brown insisted no autopsy. On one, and this is the most famous man in the world as far as soul music. And CNN ran his funeral for 2 weeks. And we had Saddam Hussein die, and we had Gerald Ford died, and they took a back seat to a 24-hour
right.
service going on CNN.
You know,
and every other station.
That's really interesting. Even I didn't know that. Wow.
Well, I did because, unfortunately, my phone rang off the hook. I was in the Supreme Court with James Brown when he died.
You know what?
Had I...
I just want to mention that Jackie's case, she sued Brown for rape in the United States Supreme Court, and they agreed to take her case. But what happened was when Brown died, the case died, except the precedent was set. And so since then, many individuals have used the precedent to sue their rapists in federal court, which I think is pretty damn interesting. And I would also mention something else. After Brown dies, Jackie, who lives in Illinois, you're going to love this part, Dan. The governor's Rod Blagojevich, the dude that was convicted of trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat and is in federal prison.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, get this, Dan. Jackie campaigned to extend the statute of limitations for reporting the crime of rape in the state of Illinois, succeeded, and Blagojevich signed that into law before he goes into jail. So there are people today who have used Jackie's law, which is what it's called, to bring their rapists to justice, which I think is sort of interesting.
Oh,
well,
that's,
it's now taken
very...
on across the United States of America. I mean, in 2010, it essentially was the law that caused the priest to come down. However, I talked with a lot of priests, and when I did it in 2010 in Illinois, you saw a lot of priests being exposed and people coming forward on my law. And then, of course, it went across the United States, and now they're using it everywhere. I'm being told they are using it on Trump, which makes it really a difficult shoes to walk in.
Oh. I'm sorry.
Very difficult shoes to walk in.
Now, before I let you go, Jackie.
I'm not my political belief, huh?
No, we won't need you to do that, I think. So, I just wanted to ask, before we let you go, just where you are at in terms of cooperation from police, how, again, not giving anything away, but where are you in terms of the cooperation from them listening to your version of, is there any development in that area?
Yes, I think that changed a little. It's been very difficult. As you know, I'm traveling and I am with a circus, and I'm actually in a show tonight. getting dressed for that show. So it's hard when you're traveling. And, of course, I've had a lot of death threats from the Brown camp, and which has made it difficult. And when you're traveling, it's hard to do all of this. But Fred and I have been very vigilant in it, and there are days, I'll admit, where I want to quit. You know, I think, you know, I'm his victim, and yet I also remember the James Brown prior to what happened to me. So I know both sides. I know the good side and the bad side of him. And that still doesn't give people an opportunity, you know, an open carte blanche to do away with someone's life. So I think it's important for history, important for the trust that, you know, $100 million that should be going to the poor and needy children across our country. I think it's very important that the truth does come out, and that, you know, I'm one of these people that say, let the dominoes fall.
Absolutely. Very interesting, your situation, and then your fight for, again, what you say and is the truth, the absolute truth about what happens with James Brown, the good and the bad and the ugly, and the truth.
Right.
I want to thank you very much for and a very applaudable, laudable fight that you are and campaign. So the best of luck to you and the
thank
very
you,
dedicated
sir.
And
thank you so
stubborn
much.
Fred Rosen. So I'm sure you'll get somewhere with this, with Fred Rosen on your side.
Well, we have our days. I mean, you know, this has become like a marriage. And I have my days where I'm more like a witch. And, you know, I'm sure Fred cringes. And then there's days where I cringe. So it's a really tight-knit working relationship that we're bouncing ideas off of each other all the time. And the same as in music. I mean, it's two writers together, and it's a hard story. And he undertook a really big mountain with this one. It wasn't just a here's the evidence, and this is where it's all going to lie. He's had to really learn, and he's had to learn 30 years. That's a lot to put in anybody's brain in just a short time.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Jackie Hollander, for coming on and talking about this, and I'm sure we'll be back again in the near future talking about this, and then when you fully realize this into a full book with Fred Rosen, it'll be very exciting to hear this and know this background story. I want to thank you very much, Fred, for coming on and talking again about the Mad Chopper and the latest development in the James Brown story. For those people that might want to contact you, how might they do that? You have a Facebook page. How might they contact you, Fred?
People can contact me through my Facebook page, and I'm going to be doing a blog pretty soon, but right now, Facebook page. And I simply would like to say I have so much humility to be on with you, Dan, and I thank you so much for your support. I don't have any words. Just thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Fred. It is always an honor and a pleasure to have you on the program, and I'm excited when Fred Rosen is excited, because I know something great is going to be turned up and turned into something very exciting, very much like the Mad Chopper tonight. Thank you very much, Jackie Hollander, and Frank. Thank you very much, Fred Rosen. Hope to talk to you again, to both of you, real soon. Have a great evening.
Adios. God bless tonight. You.
God bless you, Dan. Adios, muchacho.
Good night, my friend.
Bye-bye.